From APR, American Public Radio.
Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston C.A. Whether it's welfare reform or health reform in our day, or Social Security in an earlier time, legislators rely upon the findings of social scientists in fashioning social and economic policy. Terms like poverty, unemployment, and inequality enter the arena of public debate with great power and sweeping impact. It's more important than ever to understand just how the knowledge base of government is generated, and the ways in which it affects the making of public policy. My guest today is Michael Lacey, director of the Program in United States Studies of the Woodrow Wilson Center. Mike, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you, George. It's good to be here.
Mike, it's a great topic. It's a very important one. And let me start with this observation by way of a question. It's been observed that politics isn't just about power. It's also about uncertainty, which may surprise people, but it is. And that lawmakers spend a great deal of time in puzzling out matters. Now, I'd assume, Mike, that in that puzzling out, they use a lot of sources, public opinion, cultural attitudes, but they also use social science investigation. Could you set the stage for us and just give us a sense of how important social science investigation is to what lawmakers have to do?
I'd be happy to try to do so, at least, and I do so within the context of the a project that we've been running the last couple of years at the center, as you know, on... It's a project on government and the growth of knowledge, relationships between the growth of government on the one hand and the growth of knowledge in the social and the natural sciences on the other. And to date, as you know, we've published two volumes as a result of that project. In the second volume, the social investigation volume, we tried to establish, first of all, something that's a bit more subtle and hard to grasp than we expected it would be when we first got into this project, namely the dependence of all modern governments on an agreed, complex, compound, confused, contested, argued about body of social knowledge and information.
So kind of the grounds for debate, Michael, is that it?
Absolutely. If we take any area of social policy today, for example, take the operations of the social security system, all of those, the operations of that vast system in the United States are dependent upon a set of assumptions and beliefs about the operations of the economic system, the proper cures for or remedies for dependency, old age, forms of economic dependency, family problems of family structure, that whole kit and caboodle of problems as they came to a head in the 1930s in the U.S. and resulted finally in the passage of the Social Security Act.
Mike, I very much want to get into the history of all of this because I think its history is interesting and vital for us to understand. Before that, though, let me ask you a couple of sort of almost quick philosophical questions, if you will. As I listen to you, Mike, one thing occurs to me that, and it may be a very obvious point, but that fundamental to all of this has to be a conception of what the state is and what the state's there to do. And it seems to me that, and I'd love to get you to comment on this, view that all of this has importance and has grown in importance because the state has, over time, taken on more functions, just decided it had more to do for its people. Is this a correct notion?
Absolutely. The difficulty in discussing a question like this one, namely, what are the functions of government or more broadly of the state, the difficulty in discussing something like that is that they vary dramatically over the course of time. And so we found in the course of the conferences and workshops that led to this particular volume on social investigation, that the best proximate starting point, given our interests, was essentially the Enlightenment period in both America and in Great Britain. In other words, we were looking, loosely speaking, for that period in which we could detect a major shift in belief about what the functions of government are or ought to be or even might be. And so in this exercise, we concentrated a bit on Enlightenment era philosophies of government. We next moved on to the 19th century, where we were looking for the first fairly large-scale examples of people organizing to study in empirical detail a whole battery of social problems, from poverty to poverty and dependency to public health and a number of related issues of immigration and trade policy, for examples.
I appreciate that, Mike, and I want to look with you at in some depth at both the 18th century Enlightenment, the 19th century reform movement, and also, as you cover in the book and the project as well, some 20th century manifestations that are very important to us.
Right.
Let me, by way of asking you about it, risk this personal impression. I mean, my personal understanding of the Enlightenment is that it was a period deeply concerned with establishing a kind of humane philosophy of government, the sense that the proper study of man was mankind, and that a kind of establishing a kind of ethical and moral basis for all that was undertaken by government was fundamental. Now, disabuse me of that if I'm wrong, and build on it if I'm right, but what precisely would you say was the is the root contribution of the Enlightenment to social investigation in our country?
Well, it's let me start by qualifying what you've said just a bit. We discovered in talking through this project with the, again, I probably should have mentioned that in the case of these two volumes that the center has done, we were dealing with 20 to 25 scholars over a course of a couple of years. So there's a large inventory of conversations behind us on these subjects. With respect to the Enlightenment, the first distinction we found it necessary to make was the distinction between differing national traditions. In other words, the American Enlightenment is one thing. The French Enlightenment, probably the best known case within Western history, generally speaking, is another. The British Enlightenment is still a third thing. Each of them differs as a cultural development. If we want to stress the similarities, however, rather than the differences, what we would be dealing with in each case, it seems to me, is a new feeling of confidence on the part of people about the possibilities of knowledge for improving affairs, both for increasing abundance through the development of new styles of production and distribution, for example, or for improving human health, longevity. You know, the old tag that the Enlightenment would result in the capacity to make two great blades grow where only one had grown before captures some of this. In other words, this varying set of beliefs in the possibilities of progress.
A positive
That's right.
conception.
Through the development of a great many things, including representative government, public institutions of all sorts, the media, the press, but with a good deal of centrality or primacy accorded to science and technology. I mean, the early beliefs that the long-term development of science and technology would be the key factor in bringing about progressive improvement, both in society and in the economy.
Let me ask you this, Michael, because I think it's vital to the subject we're discussing. And again, it's an impression of mine, so once again, I'll have to ask you whether it's the right one. But it would seem to me that in terms of social investigation, and what I guess was coming to be seen as the science of legislation almost, or at least a linkage between science and legislation, is it correct to think of political economy as, in a disciplinary sense, kind of the major contribution of that time to what we've been doing ever since?
I think all scholars would agree, if you take a long enough historical perspective, it's clear that the most important new body of knowledge with respect to problems of statecraft, the most important new body of knowledge to emerge out of the Enlightenment era as a whole was political economy. In the book, we give some special attention to the Scots Enlightenment. And of course, the first book people are likely to think of when they think of the Scottish Enlightenment is Adam Smith and The Wealth of Nations. And that is an excellent text to get at all of the new assumptions about the possibilities of intelligence for coming to terms with social affairs. Now, because Smith and The Wealth of Nations over the centuries become associated primarily with a conservative, laissez-faire point of view on government. In other words, it's used as evidence for the discovery it's used as a proof text for arguments against the intervention of government in the economy. I should put it that way. Again, we have to realize that roughly simultaneously in the British case, we had development of other currents of thought, utilitarianism primarily, which argued for new forms of experiment in law. New ways of conceiving statutory possibilities. In the French case, with Condorcet, Diderot, others, we had still another style of reasoning about the possibilities of institutionalizing the development of knowledge within government and thereby immediately improving social life.
Mike, we're going to move our story into the 19th and 20th centuries in just a moment. Let me just take a moment, however, to say that this is Dialogue. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest today is Michael J. Lacy. Michael Lacy is director of the Division of United States Studies at the Woodrow Wilson Center. He was educated at Canisius College and George Washington University. He's the editor of The Truman Presidency and, with Mary Ferner, of the State and Social Investigation in Britain and the United States. Mike, as I said, I want us to turn now to the 19th century, a period which, again, a quick impression of my part from reading your fine book, becomes something of a crucible. And again, I may be overly ambitious in citing this particular phenomenon at that time, but posing it as a question, is this the period 1830 to 1890 that we see either the rise of or the basis for what I think the book refers to as the new liberalism in our society, the new sense that government can do a variety of things if properly informed that will benefit a wide number of people?
I believe that is the case. I would qualify it only in this sense. It appears if we had to sketch out, let's say that we're after simply the question, do Americans believe in an activist government or not? What we are likely to find, I think, over, say we charted this for 200 years, would be a sort of wave-like pattern. That is, we know in the antebellum period, for example, prior to the Civil War, that most state governments, which in the American case are the most important governments with reference to police powers, in other words, it's the states and localities in the U.S. that are concerned with problems of economic life and development, problems of social justice for the most part, problems of dependency, and all of the problems of poverty. They first come to rest at the doorstep of local governments and state governments. And in the 1830s and 40s, for example, we know that the state governments were very deeply involved in the development of financial institutions, in transportation. They were, many of them, Massachusetts, Georgia, Wisconsin, for example, were activist interventionist governments. In other words, it was not a laissez-faire period, to overstate it, but only slightly so. Later on in the century, laissez-faire beliefs are stronger than they were even during the Jackson period in the 1830s and 40s. So the reality, I would say, would be a complex wave-like pattern rather than a simple question of steady rise of
right.
belief in what government ought to be doing.
Mm.
But in speaking of the new liberalism, we're referring historically to the gradual development of a collectivist style of liberalism, as opposed to classical liberalism, which we define or understand in terms of its emphasis on individual rights, limited government, and a presumption against meddling on the part of the state. Broadly speaking, it's the case that the historical development of this kind of social empiricism we described earlier involve tens of thousands of separate investigations in the course of the 19th century, carried out by private groups, by church-related groups, by state governments, local governments, and as we get past the Civil War, increasingly by agencies of the national government. The relationships between that developing style of social empiricism on the one hand and the development of changing beliefs about liberalism, about what would be necessary for the state to undertake in order to make it possible to maintain an individualist style within the culture as a whole. These are very closely related things. So the new liberalism doesn't happen overnight, in other words. And in the American case, we feel that it actually takes its most important shape as a set of beliefs about the nature of society, the nature of government, the nature of law and regulation in the 1880s and 90s of the last century.
Mike, turning our story to our own century, I'm struck by just how vital the 1930s were to all that we're talking about. And it seems to me that you cannot discuss that period without discussing two seminal works that were done within it that still influence our thinking on all of this today in terms of both social theory and social description. We'd be absolutely remiss if we did not bring in our discussion at this point the powerful name of John Maynard Keynes, and his equally powerful work, The General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money. Much could be said about this, Mike, but what would you say are its fundamental contributions to social investigation and governance in this country and in England?
Well, I think it was it's certainly the case. All of the premises of your question are right in that it's certainly the case that though people in all countries are to some degree unhappy with the legacy, we're still living, broadly speaking, within a Keynesian world so far as the basic premises of public policy, the basic premises that would relate the activities of the state to the performance of national economies are concerned. Keynes has a great many critics, not only here but elsewhere. Nonetheless, he has critics but no real successors, if you see what I mean in terms of theory. And so as we saw the broad historical picture, Keynes played a pivotal role in that his general theory of 1936 held out the possibility that the state could make some progress in permanently resolving or getting more traction, let's put it that way, than had previously been possible on recurrent problems of unemployment, and that it would be able to do so without threatening in any deep sense the operations of the private or voluntary sector, the civil order as a whole. So Keynes promised in his general theory to be able to solve a problem that others had not been able to solve or even conceptualize without fatally altering the relationships between government and the civil society.
You know, Mike, if I had to cite my personal candidate for the richest discovery I made in reading the book, your books, The State and Social Investigation in Britain and the United States, it would without question be the Hoover Report. This is something that I think that, quite frankly, has gone out of public discussion. I don't think there's that much reference, and again, correct me if I'm wrong on that. An absolutely landmark study, about 1,600 pages in length, and almost an encyclopedic study of the state of America, the kitchen sink thrown in and everything else. Talk to us a bit about that. The name Hoover Report might even be a bit interesting to people. It was commissioned, I guess, by President Hoover in 1929, but it is a seminal, powerful study of what the society is all about.
The title of the report is Recent Social Trends in the United States. It appears first in 1933, as you mentioned. It's a work of many hands. I can mention some of the individuals who were involved, but they comprised what was called the President's Research Committee on Social Trends. It was a group that was initiated by President Hoover, as you mentioned, in 29, and that didn't finish up its work and appear in print until early 1933. Now, the timing here is significant because between the cup and the lip, if we want to put it that way, disaster occurred in that the Great Depression erupted. People had other things on their minds. And it's true that the entire development of the Recent Social Trends report took place in a busy, confusing, fast-moving, politically polarized environment. Nonetheless, the results of that report, the text itself to which you referred, is, as we look at it, to this day, the most sophisticated and comprehensive single piece of social analysis that was done within this American tradition of social investigation.
Mike, to conclude a conversation that I found vastly informative, I must say, I'd like to give you a kind of a crystal ball question, but in the context of the subject we're talking about in terms of our immediate times today and perhaps tomorrow. In your opinion, Mike, what's needed to assure that social science research continues to serve the needs of a complex and fragmented society? That's a vast question, but what are the principles, at least, of making this thing work in the best way it can for our society?
It's certainly the case that from the 30s on up, there has been a dramatic expansion of social science, on the one hand, through elaboration of the university system, but also a development of an increasing sophistication on the part of all of the groups who are involved in public policy argument and formulation, a skepticism that is born of experience as well as failure to think in some cases, and a popular style of relativism. Here I know that this is a stereotype, but a popular style of relativism that would discount any argument about social affairs by focusing on the ways that argument would bear on group A differentially from group B. So the outcome of it is that the confidence in the intelligibility of social affairs that we began by talking about at the beginning of the conversation, or our confidence in the ability of scientists or reasoners or government officials or commission members to achieve objectivity, our confidence in both of those things is not what it was a century ago. There's just no doubt about that. Now, as a practical matter, I think we ought to pay more attention in the future to consulting with people whom we can predict in advance are going to be adversaries to new reports on environmental matters or on civil rights or on the condition of labor unions and the reasons for that condition. You can take your choice in any of those domains. All of us understand, I think, instinctively, given the historic grievances that are involved, that any report on any of those subjects is going to run into criticism from the groups that are directly involved. We should be able to imagine ways to consult with all parties to social controversy, and we ought to be experimenting with that. We ought to be able to find out whether there are new ways to design social research at the beginning in such a way that it will be more useful to more people, that we can ask the right questions more efficiently, perhaps, than we have in the past, or at least anticipate criticisms and legitimate criticisms and do something about them by incorporating responses to them in the work early enough that we can make subsequent disagreements more efficient. The question, in other words, the trick would be not to banish disagreement, which is going to be inevitable. That's what politics is all about. But somehow to make it more efficient from a moral or an ethical point of view. We want to have a clearer understanding of exactly what our differences are so that we can do something about them.
I think that's very wise counsel indeed, Mike Lacy. And thank you so much for being with us today on Dialogue.
Good to be here.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Michael Lacy, Director of the Division of United States Studies at the Woodrow Wilson Center, and editor, with Mary Ferner, of the State and Social Investigation in Britain and the United States. I am George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Assistant producer is Dennis Saunier. Our technical director is John Tyler. Dialogue is presented by APR, American Public Radio, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in association with Radio Smithsonian. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For a cassette copy of this program, or for more information, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. That's 1-800-747-7444.
From APR, American Public Radio.